This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm Kathleen Harris. Glad to be with you again.
And if you've listened to this program over the last several weeks, I've described three phases of a bull market. I also gave my opinion as to which phase I think the stock market is in now. Now, I've been in this business for close to three decades now, actually a little over that, and I can tell you there's a pattern of investor behavior that starts to emerge as the bull market moves through, let's say, the public participation phase through the excess or the mania phase. That's how bull markets end. Everything is going wonderfully well. The economy is booming. The stock market is booming. And it seems like the good times will never end. But what happens as we transition to that phase is fear becomes greed and caution becomes overconfidence. And during those periods of greed and overconfidence, well, the average investor will often decide to actively trade their own assets and try to capitalize on, well, the sure thing. Actually, when the markets are going up, everybody thinks we're all going to get rich. They think what is happening in the market will continue forever. Now, day trading, as you recall, in the tech boom, was a big craze before the tech bubble burst. And house flipping was the hot item before the housing bubble burst. But what is the craze this time around? Well, this time around, investors seem to be chasing returns using exchange-traded funds, also known as ETFs. Are these low-cost investment vehicles the answer to today's choppy markets and volatility? And should investors finally actively manage ETFs or stick to passive ETFs? Just buy an ETF, an index fund, and just simply sit on it. That's what Kathleen and I are going to discuss today about ETF strategies and what you can do, whether they're appropriate for you. Can you manage them yourself? Or in today's volatile markets, are more active management required?
And then coming up on the second half of our program, as many of you know, Jim and I often discuss health topics on this program as well. And the reason for that is that your health situation dramatically impacts your costs in retirement as well as the quality of your retirement years. So today we're going to focus on an illness that affects roughly 1 out of 100 people, rheumatoid arthritis. Now, rheumatoid arthritis can be an expensive illness to treat. Medications can cost between $1,000 and $3,000 a month. Unbelievable. If it's left untreated for too long. So today on the program, Dr. Eric Mattson, Chair of Rheumatology at the Mayo Clinic, is going to help us figure out how to get an early diagnosis of this illness and give us some symptoms to watch for so we can diagnose the illness early and avoid paying such a huge amount for medications in our retirement years.
Now, I want to go back to what we're going to be talking about today is ETFs. Why are they so popular where, let's say, for decades, everybody was familiar with a mutual fund? Why has investments for individuals and even at the institutional level switched over to ETFs? Let me point out some similarities in things that are different. First of all, ETFs trade like a stock. You can buy an ETF at 6:30 when the market opens here on the West Coast, or you can buy it 5 minutes before the market close. On the other hand, if you want to invest in a mutual fund, you get the valuation or the net asset value of that mutual fund at the end of the day. On an ETF, you pay a commission just like you would buying a stock. Mutual funds, well, there are things called no loads where there's no commissions, partial loads, back loads, or upfront loads, and it also depends on the amount of time that you hold them. Now, the average expenses are usually less than for an ETF because they're usually passive indexes. Let's say the S&P 500, it's no different than an S&P 500 mutual fund. There is no management. They just buy the stocks that make up the S&P 500 and that's it. On the other hand, if you take a look at a mutual fund, the expenses can be a little bit higher because you're getting active management. And finally, ETFs have a little bit more tax efficiency because they buy the stocks in the index, whatever it is, if it's an index of a market like let's say the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ 100, or even a sector ETF, for example, in energy. They'll buy, for example, the stocks that make up the energy stocks in the S&P 500. On the other hand, mutual funds are actively managed. They have dividends. Sometimes the fund manager will sell a stock, take capital gains, and you as an owner of that mutual fund will get a year-end distribution or a capital gain, and you'll end up paying taxes on it. The only time you pay taxes on an ETF is when you sell it if you have a profit. So those are some of the main differences between the two of them. And one of the reasons I think ETFs have become popular is you can trade them like stocks. You don't have to wait to the end of the day to find out what you got into the mutual fund. If you buy an ETF, it's selling at, let's say, $10 a share. You place your trade, you can get it at $10 a share. It doesn't matter if it's 6:30 in the morning or, once again, 5 minutes before the market closes.
I think another big thing that I've been hearing a lot about recently, Jim, when it comes to ETFs versus mutual funds, is this whole question of what they call active management versus passive management. Now, what in the world does that mean? You know what? I'm actually going to start with passive management. You know, you often hear people saying, you know, I want to beat the S&P 500. I want to beat the Dow Jones Industrial Index or what have you. Most people don't realize you cannot invest directly in an index. All an index is a statistic. It's not an actual tangible thing. It's informational. It's statistical. It's not an actual entity. So in order to get performance like an index, there are passively managed mutual funds and passively managed exchange-traded funds, which means that those fund managers will buy stock in the same proportion as those same stocks appear on a specific index. And then that's all they do. They rebalance the portfolio whenever the S&P rebalances their index or the Dow Jones. You know, you hear about stocks being pushed out of the NASDAQ or being pushed out of the Dow Jones and new stocks coming in or stocks being reweighted. So those passive managers essentially rebalance their portfolio so that it's always matching as closely as possible what's going on in terms of how the indexes themselves are being statistically made up. Now, when it comes to active management, on the other hand, typically when you have an active management type of a fund, whether it's a mutual fund or an exchange-traded fund, usually the fund has some sort of prospectus that outlines the purpose of the fund, the trading strategy of the fund, the target investment of the fund, and the manager is doing his or her best to invest for the best profit available based on the criteria governing the investments in that fund. So, been hearing a lot of information recently saying that passive strategies have typically outperformed actively managed strategies. And I think this is really interesting, Jim, because I think it leads to people having a false idea that they can invest in an ETF index fund and they're going to outperform all other investment classes. And why I find this interesting is I found this quote from an asset manager who made the following observation, and he says, "In my 20 plus years managing money, I have not met yet a single investor who put all of their cash into a broad market index ad infinitum. Rather, they combine them with bond indexes or funds or peel back on the large caps inherent in the SPY, add a concentration of smaller mid-cap focused investments, and by so doing, they become de facto active managers." And that's from Oliver Pershing Forbes from a January article that he wrote. And I find this interesting, Jim, because I think it may be true that there are certain passively managed funds that outperform certain actively managed funds. But as this gentleman points out, if you're dipping your toes in and out, blending things together, you essentially are acting as an active manager of your own portfolio. And the chances of you outperforming index funds is just going to be as good as your ability to pick and choose those funds or ETFs and your ability to decide when to move in, when to move out.
And let's talk about one of the reasons why ETFs and mutual funds have become responsible, depending on one's, let's say, amount of capital that you have available for diversification. Most people don't have enough assets to get diversification with individual stocks or bonds. And it's easy because you can go into a sector, let's say you think that the energy sector, precious metals, or maybe industrial stocks or healthcare, some of the leaders, or even technology that has been leading the market, you can buy buy a sector fund that mirrors that particular sector with all the companies that make it up. So if that sector is doing well, well, you can participate on the upside. So I think these are one of the reasons why ETFs have become popular, as well as mutual funds.
Well, I think this is an important point to touch home on, Jim, because I know that we here, if we have less than $25,000 to work with a client portfolio, we're pretty much using ETFs and mutual funds to get good diversification in that person's account, just because we can't get good diversification using individual stocks or bonds. So we're pretty much forced to use ETFs or mutual funds to get good diversification. So I think this whole idea of diversification is really an idea that people can keep in mind if their asset level isn't high enough yet to do individual stocks or individual bonds. I think that there's still some challenges, though, Jim, in terms of investing in ETFs, for example. Get the question, are ETFs a safe investment? Are mutual funds a safe investment? Are they safer than stocks? Are they safer than bonds? And the answer to that question is not necessarily, because they're made up of those underlying instruments. Mutual funds are made up of underlying stocks or stocks and bonds. Same thing with ETFs. And this creates kind of a problem, because as an investor in those mutual funds and in those ETFs, you have absolutely no control over what the underlying investments in those particular instruments are, which means that decisions to move in and out of the instrument overall are fully in your hands, meaning you have to be very disciplined with how you move in and out of these particular instruments. So you still have to decide when to buy and when to sell an ETF, when to buy and when to sell a mutual fund. And if you're doing a sector-focused approach, you'll still need to decide, when do I move into the sector? When do I move out of the sector? So this can be a challenge for people who need a specific level of income from their investments, again, because they can't control the underlying assets that they're invested in, because they're not managing the investment a third party is.
And there are a number of other issues, too, that relate to either mutual funds, especially sector funds, if you're going in that direction, or sector ETFs. And the best example I can give you is last year. What most people remember about 2013 is the market was up 30%, one of the best returns we've seen in the market in almost half a century. But the market last year was composed of different segments and different sectors that did well. In the first part of the year, the economy was slowing down. Yes, people were going into the stock market, but they were going into those sectors that would be considered relatively safe. Remember, most investors were sitting on the sidelines or putting their money into bond funds. So if you look at the market last year, up until May, when Ben Bernanke first started talking about the taper, what did well last year in the first part of the year were utilities, consumer staples, and healthcare. These are the kind of stocks that you would go into if we were heading into a recession, the economy was slowing down, or more importantly, we were heading into a bear market. But voila, Ben Bernanke goes before Capitol Hill in the first week of May, and he mentions something that nobody was expecting. We're going to start cutting back on the amount of money that we're printing, called tapering. And the markets pulled back with a precipitous drop, 7.5% over a six-week period of time. Now, the Fed later reversed themselves in the month of June and said, look, we're not really tightening, and we're a ways from actually starting tapering. It's all going to be dependent on the economy. In fact, the Fed held off to announcing its first taper until December at the end of the year, with the first taper coming January of this year. And it's widely expected when the Fed meets in March, they'll announce another taper. But what happened when Bernanke changed the landscape? The markets changed. And what did well in the first part of the year, utilities, consumer staples, they actually fell. And healthcare, which continued to do well, shifted from big cap blue chip stocks like pharmaceuticals over to very speculative biotechnology stocks. What really did well were industrials, cyclicals, financials, and technology stocks. So the market changed. And if you listen to the weekend program where we have well-known technicians that come on the program, the one message you hear from almost universally from all of them is they've never seen rotations as quick as they occur today. Gone are the days when you can pick a sector, whether it's technology, energy, whatever the sector is, consumer staples, and you just sit buy and hold for a couple of years in a normal market cycle. Today, you can get two or three rotations in a year. And those things that went up so much in the first part of the year, like utility stocks, ended up the rest of the year falling and dropping in value. In other words, you gave back most of the gains in the first part of the year. So things change in this kind of market where you have government intervention, you have quantitative easing globally, and we go through this back and forth start, restart in the economy. This year, we're starting out on a slow note. Most economists are now revising their GDP estimates for the first part of the year, following a revision of the fourth quarter of the year when the economy began to slow down as inventories began to build. So we've been on this fit and start cycle ever since this recovery began in 2009. You remember in 2010 when the economy was doing well, the Fed was tapering, the tapering ended, the economy rolled over, and lo and behold, instead of an exit plan, the Fed launched QE2. And of course, now we have QE3 and QE4.
I think this whole concept, Jim, about the how fast the economy is changing, especially as it relates to what's happening at the Federal Reserve, particularly right now, really brings home the point that whether you're doing individual stocks or bonds or ETFs or mutual funds, you have to be actively involved in knowing what's going on with your investment. So whether or not you invest in a mutual fund or an ETF, you either have to have the discipline to say, I'm going to ride this thing up and down, which basically means you're going to be a passive investor, or you have some sort of planned exit and entry strategy, knowing when you're planning to move your ETF investments out of the market, partially out of the market, back into the market. I guess what I'm getting at, Jim, is that an ETF is not a fix-it-all solution. It's one of many tools investors should be considering when they think about managing their assets or having someone manage their assets, but it's not going to fix everything. It has its pros and its cons, like every other investment vehicle out there. And so if you're planning on using an ETF, you need to have a very specific strategy for doing so. I want to talk about a specific couple and a case that we had where this whole idea of not being able to control the underlying investments in an ETF really made a big difference to a couple's quality of life. We met Ron and Meg. They're a couple in their early 70s. They've been retired for several years now, and they've been really enjoying themselves. They've been traveling a lot. They've been doing a lot of things they kept wanting to do when they were working but just couldn't get done. They've been spending a lot of time refurbishing old vehicles, one of their favorite hobbies. They've been spending a lot of time at antique shows. They love to collect antiques, but they've kind of been running into a problem. They have a $1.5 million portfolio, and it's been invested in a corporate bond ETF ever since they retired. Now, when they first retired in 2008, of course, they were scared of stocks, so they went into a bond ETF. And at the time, the bond ETF was paying a 6% yield, and so they were getting $90,000 a year from their bond ETF. Now, over time, and this should be no big surprise to anyone that's been listening to the program, as interest rates kept dropping, so did the yield on their ETF portfolio because, again, they didn't have control over the underlying investments. So right now, that same exact ETF that was yielding 6% and over in 2008 is only yielding 3.5%. That means that their income from their investments has dropped from $90,000 to almost $53,000. That's a pretty significant and painful drop. And so what they've been doing is making up that shortfall by dipping into their principal. They've been spending less on their hobbies. They've been dipping into other types of resources, but they're getting a little concerned that they keep dipping into their principal. So they came to us looking for a solution to how to get out of this bind of dipping into their principal to try to meet their income needs.
So what we did is we came up with a portfolio that was evenly split between both portfolios in bonds and dividend stocks. The difference this time around, the bond portfolio produced a predictable income. There weren't going to be any changes. There were definite maturities, something that they didn't have in their bond ETF. Now, they also needed a rising income stream over time because, like all of us, we face inflation in one form or another. Just take a look at what you're paying for things today, your utility bills, your healthcare premiums, gasoline, groceries, whatever it is. For most people, their living expenses are going up annually. And for those that are retired, they really start to go up in the latter years of their retirement, especially if they have any sickness, drug medications, or illnesses. And we know that the government is shifting more of the cost of health care onto us as consumers. So we put 50% in bonds to cover most of their income needs, and another 50% in blue chip dividend paying stocks. And what we did is the bond portfolio produced roughly about $27,000 a year. Average income on that portfolio, a little over 3.5%. And then the other half was in dividend paying stocks, paying income over $21,000. And that had a dividend yield roughly of 2.8%. And what we did is anytime there were some capital gains that we took in the portfolio, we put it in a cash money market fund, and we would save that for those extra expenses that come at the end of the year. For example, taking a trip or any other things that come up in the course of living. That way, we were taking the extra money from capital appreciation rather than dipping into principal. And so here we had a balanced approach that was predictable. We knew exactly what we were going to receive from income on the bond portfolio, and we also knew what the dividends were because these were blue chip companies, many of them going back to the Great Depression, never skipping a dividend. And more importantly, those dividends were going up each year, even during the Great Depression.
I think what was so powerful for this couple, Jim, about this solution is that they had full transparency as far as what they were invested in and knew exactly what each individual portion of their portfolio was paying. They knew what each bond was paying. They knew what dividend each stock was paying. So they could kind of get a better handle on their income stream from their portfolio. Now, just one little bit of caution here. You know, Jim and I have talked about strategies that allow you to take capital appreciation, take those gains and use them as income. If you're doing that type of a strategy where you're counting on some capital appreciation for your income, obviously those types of strategies need to be pretty closely monitored. But again, in this case, Ron and Meg are just really excited about the fact that they can have full transparency and more predictability as far as where their income is coming from and how much it is.
So as we conclude this week's program, a couple issues I'd like to point out. Take control of your health, and especially as you look down the road with the expenses that can come up, as we're going to talk about here shortly, rheumatoid arthritis. Is early diagnosis the key? As we talk with Dr. Eric Mattson, Chair of Rheumatology at the Mayo Clinic, coming up right after this.
Thanks for joining us on today's Lifetime Income program on Financial Sense NewsHour. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about rheumatoid arthritis. Now, this is different from the osteoarthritis you might be familiar with. It's actually an inflammatory disease. It affects about 1.3 million Americans, and there's a high risk of disability and mortality for people with rheumatoid arthritis, and the costs are not insignificant. As you know, Jim and I have brought up a couple of different health topics on this program, mostly to help you understand the possible costs involved with different health conditions you might end up developing in retirement. So today on the program, our guest expert is Dr. Eric Mattson, who's the chair of rheumatology at the Mayo Clinic. So we're looking forward to having him on the program. Welcome, Dr. Mattson. Why don't we just start off by talking about the prevalence of rheumatoid arthritis in terms of the general population?
Okay, well, it's very helpful to talk about the prevalence of rheumatoid arthritis, particularly as it affects people in retirement age. The prevalence of rheumatoid arthritis, in fact, in people who are retirement age is about 3%, so 3 in 100. Although it's a disease that you can get any time between infancy and 100 years old, most people who get rheumatoid arthritis, the average age is right around 55. So as people are starting to approach retirement years, when the peak incidence of getting rheumatoid arthritis is. And then because people are living longer, there's more and more people now who have rheumatoid arthritis into their retirement years.
What are some of the risk factors in terms of developing this condition?
So the cause of rheumatoid arthritis is not known. What we do know is that there are several risk factors that in the right setting, that is people who have certain genetic makeup, maybe certain family background, factors that can play a role in developing rheumatoid arthritis include smoking. That's definitely a big risk factor that doubles your risk for getting rheumatoid arthritis. And being overweight is also a risk factor for developing rheumatoid arthritis. If you have somebody in your family with rheumatoid arthritis, that approximately doubles your risk depending upon what their relationship is to you. So those are some important risk factors that we know about.
And what are some of the symptoms? How would someone know if they were developing rheumatoid arthritis?
Rheumatoid arthritis is a autoimmune inflammatory disease. So it's not the wear and tear arthritis that we know about, degenerative arthritis or osteoarthritis, but rather it's because of an overactive immune system that attacks the lining around the joints and causes joint damage and can affect other organs as well. The symptoms then are swelling of joints. So profound stiffness that is out of the ordinary. All of us feel a little stiff usually when we get older as we get up out of bed for a few minutes, but we can walk that off. But in rheumatoid arthritis, it can take hours to get unstiff. Our hands and feet can swell up. We become fatigued, anemic, and have a great deal of difficulty performing our daily activities of work and personal care and our avocational activities.
So it sounds like this could basically interfere with your daily life, but I also heard you mention it can affect other organs. So how serious is this condition?
It's a very serious condition. People with rheumatoid arthritis who have involvement of organs such as the heart, lungs, eyes, blood vessels, have a life expectancy that's lower than people who don't have rheumatoid arthritis. It can shave several years off your life expectancy, as well as profoundly worsen your quality of life.
So if you have rheumatoid arthritis, and you mentioned the heart as being one of the possible organs affected, is there anything that you can do to sort of try to prevent the rheumatoid arthritis from exacerbating a heart condition?
Rheumatoid arthritis actually is associated with an increased risk for heart disease. And we think that's because of the inflammation that is part of rheumatoid arthritis, not just inflammation in the joints, it's inflammation throughout the whole body. And that inflammation affects blood vessels too. So the most important things are to control the rheumatoid arthritis, because controlling the rheumatoid arthritis reduces the risks of heart disease.
What are some ways to control the disease in that case? What are the treatments and the cost of those treatments?
There are actually quite a few treatments. The treatment of rheumatoid arthritis today is much more effective than it was in the past. It's still not a trivial disease, and it's still a very costly disease because people with rheumatoid arthritis wind up still going out of the workforce early. They wind up having more joint surgeries than people who don't have rheumatoid arthritis. Even though the rate of joint surgeries over the last 15 to 20 years is actually going down because we are doing a better job controlling their disease. The drugs that are used are drugs that suppress the immune system. So these are called disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, or DMARDs, DMARDs, and they're drugs that some of them are chemotherapy drugs like methotrexate. That's methotrexate, and also a host of drugs called biologics, like you see advertised on TV, Enbrel, Humira, Orencia, and drugs like those. It's an expensive disease, for sure. The drugs are costly. The cost of not treating the disease is even costlier. The cost of the biologic drugs runs around $20,000 to $30,000 a year.
Wow, that is a lot of money.
A lot of money, yep. So it's very important for people as they get older to make sure that they have very good insurance. It's really critical. Looking after your insurance, having a good doctor, and honestly, being financially savvy to save money for the retirement, because a lot of these things that happen to people occur in retirement age and cost money. Some things that you can do to sort of be prepared, besides those things I just talked about, are to make some adaptations in your home. That's even good advice for people who don't have rheumatoid arthritis, but who have just more of the general form of arthritis, degenerative arthritis or osteoarthritis. So adapting your home so people can continue living in their home is very important. That's things like having rails in the bathroom, having doors that are wide enough, thinking about, are you going to be able to get up and down stairs?
Door handles.
Door handles, right, so that's easier to manage the doors. Maybe your house just isn't suitable for somebody who has real severe arthritis, and being able to live on a one level is something to think about. So moving the laundry room up to the ground floor is something that a lot of people wind up doing, or even changing the living situation and moving to a different home. what advice I give about that is if you're thinking about that, do it sooner than later so that you get used to your new home and your new environment.
Something we very commonly encourage people to do is to really think about, if you're going to plan on aging in place, think about the place you're going to be aging in if it's not appropriate.
I like that. That's a good slogan.
Because you're right. And all these things, of course, these modifications, they're not extremely expensive, but again, they're costs you have to start figuring into your retirement planning as well. What about things like occupational or physical therapy? Are those treatment strategies that are effective with rheumatoid arthritis?
So they are, and those are things that we try to get people to learn that is really thought of as lifelong learning and lifelong therapy. So things that you learn in occupational and physical therapy are things that you're going to do at home. And one of the key principles with all of this is keeping physically active. So it depends, of course, on how bad your arthritis is, but for everyone who has arthritis, some amount of physical activity and having the mindset of pursuing some amount of physical activity every day is very important to keeping your strength and actually keeping the arthritis under control.
Are there any sort of preferred methods of physical activity like walking or swimming?
The most natural thing you can do is walking, and that's first advice that I give people. Swimming and biking, also good, especially for people who have problems with their feet or knees or hips. The activity, though, has to be tailored to the person. If you have very bad shoulders, you're not going to be swimming, but you can walk or bike, and those are things that one can do lifelong.
I was going to ask as well, getting back to the cost of this disease, you'd mentioned that there are some drugs that might be required that would cost between $20,000 and $30,000 a year, which is just an unbelievable price tag. You also mentioned joint replacement surgery.
Right.
How much do those typically run, and how can you prep for whether or not you're going to need joint replacement surgery?
Well, the best thing is for us to have the arthritis under very good control so that we reduce the need for joint surgery, which we are doing. But still, it turns out that people with rheumatoid arthritis actually now, like people in the general population, are winding up needing especially hip and knee replacements. And typically somewhat younger age than people who have osteoarthritis or degenerative arthritis, but it's very individual. And the cost of those surgeries, they run $30,000 to $50,000. They can be more if it's complicated. So again, one of the best things you can do to prepare yourself is to have very good health insurance.
Right. And I was going to say, those that I know that have had these joint replacement surgeries, oftentimes after 5 or 7 years, go back for replacement surgeries as well.
That's true. That's less frequent in patients with rheumatoid arthritis because they're not as hard on their joints. But that's definitely true.
Is there anything else our listeners should be aware of in terms of risk prevention with this or treatment with this disease before we send you off to take care of the rest of your patient load today?
Thank you. So I guess just for your purposes, having rheumatoid arthritis can profoundly affect your quality of life in your retirement, and it can profoundly affect your financial resources, and it's something that is really important to be prepared for, and these things that we talked about are, I think, the best things to do to be prepared.
Well, Dr. Mattson, I really want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us. Really appreciate you coming on our program today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. So for those of you who might be listening, if you have some of the symptoms discussed by Dr. Mattson, as he mentioned, early treatment and diagnosis is the best way of preventing serious problems from developing with this condition. And I also wanted to just point out something that Dr. Mattson had touched on as well. And this applies to anyone who's planning on staying in their primary residence as they age. As he mentioned, rheumatoid arthritis makes it very difficult to get around a traditional home setup. So, like with many other conditions you might develop in your retirement years, it's really important to keep in mind, can you be mobile? Can you be functional in your own home in your retirement years? Or do some modifications need to be made? And to take care of those now while you're still mobile and able, and you still have a little bit of money in that retirement pot, so you go ahead and take care of these things. So again, if you have those symptoms, make sure you reach out to your care provider. Until we talk to you again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries. or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.